overnight show.
The Camilla's tour of America has all eyes on the controversial couple.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
News can be a poison sometimes. Newspaper owners learned years ago that people buy frightening headlines. The motto of TV news? If it bleeds, it leads. The most horrific stories get top billing. We all need to turn away from time to time, to those we love, to amazing nature and the trivia that convinces us to go on for another day. Lately, the climate news is too shocking, even for Radio EcoShock. In the last 2 weeks, I've been rebuilding myself, and hopefully you, the listener, with backstop nourishment. We had programs on your food security plans and how to change, how to be the change that you desire. Meanwhile, I've looked for a way to communicate the probability of catastrophe without knocking out our will to live and our activism. And you know, hope shows up in the most improbable places. In the last half of this program, after an overview of our predicament, we'll explore how the economic crash may delay the worst of climate disruption. Isn't that a twist? We may get time to save the ecosphere due to our incompetence and even criminality. Hang in as Phil England of Climate Radio arrives with experts calling for a planned economic contraction to save the remnants of the natural world. He'll interview Tim Helwick Larson, director of the Public Interest Research Center at www.pirc.info. That's in Germany. Phil has a regular program on Radiance FM in London. That's our second half hour, along with a little Black Depression humor called the Global Meltdown Derby. Before that, you'll hear an overview of climate and peak oil from Professor Thomas Homer Dixon. I've prepared a digest of his new presentation to a committee in the British Parliament. It's crammed with science and analysis from his new book, Carbon Shift, including a rethink of how can we respond given the near bankruptcy of governments and financial institutions. But first, the horrible climate news. Red flags, warnings, and howling about climate shifts are pouring out of scientific institutions around the world. Here is just a small sample. MIT's Center for Global Change Science predicts global heating could be twice the level predicted by world scientists just 6 years ago, or more. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology model allows testing of various human responses, economic developments, energy use, along with the workings of the atmosphere, the oceans, and biological systems. They change various parameters with 400 runs of the model, and that leads to projections of a world hotter by 5.2 degrees Celsius by 2100. That is 9 degrees Fahrenheit. A huge jump in a very short period of time, likely faster than anything that has ever happened in Earth's long history. The range of 90% probability, those things that are very likely, the models run from 3.5 degrees at the very best to 7.4 degrees at the worst. Now previously, in 2003, peer-reviewed science projected a median of only 2.4 degrees Celsius or 4 degrees Fahrenheit. Our children and grandchildren will very likely see at least twice that much heating. The study was published in the May issue of the American Meteorological Society's Journal of Climate. Andrei Sokolov is the lead author. MIT's statement calls for rapid and massive action to prevent a catastrophic warming. A spokesman for the MIT team said the consequences of such changes would be off the known scale. They are unthinkable. A 7.4 centigrade rise would mean severe ecosystem collapse worldwide with total economic collapse in many parts of the world. The planet would face resource wars between people, and you can safely say many, many hundreds of millions of people would die, so said the MIT. The same message was delivered at a meeting of Nobel laureates in London at the end of May. It was organized by Joachim Schellenhuber of the Potsdam Institute on Climate Impact Research, that's based in Germany. These top scientists said global greenhouse gas emissions must peak by 2015, just 6 years away, and then decline rapidly to avoid a new greenhouse world. That has severe implications for our current energy use, and especially for newly industrializing countries like China and India. These Nobel laureates call for global carbon pricing, aid for those countries faced with adaptation to climate shift, and emergency action to stop deforestation. All of these calls for action, they say, are based on solid, peer-reviewed science. Meanwhile, according to an article by Stacy Feldman at SolveClimate.com, quote, greenhouse gas emissions skyrocketed 15% between 2000 and 2005, according to new numbers from the Emission Database for Global Atmospheric Research, or EDGAR. For context, the rate of emissions growth was just 3% for the period 1990 to 1995 and 6% between 1995 and the year 2000. So just repeating, it's gone up 15% between 2000 and 2005. Stacy Feldman continues, the future looks even worse. Without a global treaty, carbon emissions will surge nearly 39% by 2030. The Global Information Administration, the EIA, predicted this week. Ending that quote. All of these scientists hope to stimulate dramatic action in climate negotiations going on in Bonn, Germany, for a replacement to the old Kyoto Treaty. Google's St. James Palace Nobel Laureate Memorandum to get the details. St. James Palace Nobel Laureate Memorandum. So, this is it, folks. It sounds like a science fiction script, but it's real, and it's happening now. All over the world, scientists are measuring millions of fossil bits, ice cores, satellite measurements, ocean instruments, birds and bacteria, just to test for truth. The results are coming in faster, almost too fast for the supercomputers to tabulate, and too frightening for most of us to think about. All the rest of human history shrinks before our present time. Will we sink into denial and war, or adapt in time? You be the judge.
No, but really, if we want to prepare our children for the coming global changes, we need to raise them in little hot houses. Greenhouses, put their crib in a place that's about 10 degrees hotter than where you are, and just adapt them in a drier, hotter environment. Don't let them drink much water.
Here is another voice, an honest, intelligent one, in my opinion. Thomas Homer Dixon to the members of the British Parliament. After that, the wild twist, as UK broadcaster Phil England asks, can the economic downturn save us? This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hundreds of millions of people are going to die. That's a fact.
Hundreds of millions of people will die. How?
Global warming.
Says the end of the world is coming.
That's what we need, another nut job walking the streets.
Two armed forces are racing toward us from the future. One is peak oil, the end of the oil age. The other is climate change, which will hit us first and worst. Meanwhile, and not unrelated, our economy is collapsing. How shall we spend the last of our resources? Canadian author and scholar Thomas Homer Dixon works through these questions in his presentation to a group of British parliamentarians. It was May 6, 2009, to the All-Party Parliamentary Group on peak oil and gas. The topic, responding to the converging crisis of the 21st century. Of course, the British government cannot afford good technical help in these economic times. As Professor Homer Dixon moves to his slides, the audio booms with too many echoes for straight radio broadcast, so I can't play it for you. I've noticed the same in the American capital, where the off-site audience almost invariably gets amateur to bad audio on webcasts or net postings. Ditto Al Gore's important speech from Poznan, we couldn't hear that. Critical climate and energy information doesn't get passed on due to poor recording techniques, and that's the sad truth. So I'm going to hit a few of the high notes from this important speech by Homer Dixon. I'll point you to my Radio EcoShock blog for June 11th, where you will find links to download the entire speech, the Q&A session, and the accompanying slides. Just click on blog at ecoshock.org and you'll be there. Thomas Homer Dixon is the author of The Upside of Down and The Ingenuity Gap. We carried an interview with him on the EcoShock show for February 13th, 2009. You can download that from our archives. The interview previewed Homer Dixon's new book, Carbon Shift, How the Twin Crises of Oil Depletion and Climate Change Will Define the Future. That was released in Canada in April. Now get more solid details in this new speech to the British legislators. Thomas is one of the big-scale thinkers, with a mind that can stretch across many different academic disciplines. He has a talent for developing a coherent picture out of the fog. We always learn from him not just facts, but ways to describe these big new changes arriving almost daily. And that is the problem, isn't it? We're saturated with new information, some of it conflicting, all of it about change. Homer Dixon explains a new model being used by top scientific institutions and eventually by governments will look inside this power technique. Let's start with our original question, peak oil or climate change? Of course, it turns out these two are closely interconnected. New energy like solar or wind could help solve both. But turning to cheap, abundant coal could also be a solution for just oil shortages. We might convert the coal into gas. That has been done already. We know the technique. But the coal option is disastrous for the other one, for climate. It floods the atmosphere and the ocean with excess carbon dioxide. Even Homer Dixon seems torn on this issue. On the one hand, along with Canadian energy whiz Mark Jacquard, Thomas warns that, faced with ever-increasing oil and gas costs, countries like the United States, China, and India will turn to coal again. This runs completely counter to what we thought was happening. All sorts of theorists agreed that the world was decarbonizing its energy supplies, moving up the ladder to cleaner fuels. The United Kingdom, for example, closed down its dirty coal industry in favor of new North Sea gas supplies, a cleaner fuel. From coal to oil to gas and then to renewable energies, that was the mantra of energy economists. I would add that the problem with coal applies to America as well. For all his climate-friendly appointments, Barack Obama has not ordered an end to mountaintop removal for coal, or even a rapid cutback of this atmospheric poison. The latest climate bill, Waxman-Markey, went soft on the coal lobby, I'm sorry to say, and on the millions of Midwestern Democrats who rely on coal for up to 95% of their electricity.
Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
Peabody's the world's largest coal producer. In 2004 alone, the company sold 227 million tons of coal, reaping revenues of $3.6 billion. With operations throughout the Intermountain West, Appalachia, the Midwest, Australia, and Venezuela, Peabody Energy fuels more than 10% of all U.S. electricity and supplies 3% of the entire world's electrical needs.
Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
Now, as conventional oil peaks, Homer Dixon warns we are recarbonizing, going to dirty tar sands and back to more and more coal. Despite what we know about climate threats, the world is recarbonizing with coal, driven by rising prices and shrinking supplies, in other words, by peak oil. Homer Dixon suggests the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change will have to add peak energy problems to its research and reports as one problem merges with the other. Thinkers like Jacquard and Homer Dixon accept more coal use as immoral and yet inevitable. We cannot control China's coal use, and the Chinese show no inclination to do so. Therefore, Homer Dixon says to the British politicians and in his book Carbon Shift, we will have to develop real clean coal technology. Certainly more efficient furnaces to start, but then a combination of pumping carbon back into the ground and a new, unproven technology of turning coal into gas in sealed underground facilities. Personally, I think this is folly. After a few more environmental disasters, crop failures driven by heat and drought, cities destroyed by violent storms or new insect plagues, eventually, whole populations will react angrily to coal as the climate killer that it is. The reaction may begin as boycotts and protests, but it could turn as nasty as destructive rebellions. I could even see the day when renegade coal plants are bombed, perhaps the subject of wars, just to stop escalating climate disorders. Clean coal is sort of like helpful heroin. It's black death for the planet, I say. Okay, it's a contentious issue. Thomas Homer Dixon says the dance between peak oil and climate disruption illustrates a larger misunderstanding in our thinking, and this is the model I was talking about. Most of us continue to consider one problem at a time with many proposed solutions. In fact, says Homer Dixon and the new academia, we need to comprehend complex systems. Our civilization and nature itself is a maze of interconnected, complex systems. We set out to change one situation, and something completely unexpected shifts in a way we never considered. It is, to paraphrase one of the world's worst statesmen, an unknown unknown. That means we cannot manage the real world. Let's spend a little time with Homer Dixon on this, because our future survival may depend upon getting reality right. These are clips taken from the UK speech.
Now, a general conceptual point I want to make before I start talking specifically about climate change and energy is the need to shift our view of the world. And in many ways, I think this is the most fundamental argument I've been trying to make for many years now. We need to shift our view of the world from seeing it as composed of machines to seeing it as composed of complex systems. So we'll spend a little bit of time unpacking this idea. When I talk about this with my students, I take a wind-up, 1920s wind-up mantle clock into class, and I put it on my desk, and I say, I can take this thing apart. I can break it down into its bits and pieces, its bushings and its screws and its cogwheels and springs and things. And I can understand how those pieces work together very precisely. And if the clock isn't working properly when I put all the pieces back together in the right places, I can usually attribute the problem to one piece and say there's the problem. And it makes the sense. It makes sense to say that the clock isn't working properly. That it's a statement that has content. All of those things really don't happen or aren't true with complex systems. I would argue that one of the challenges that we face in this world, and in fact one of the contributors to our recent economic crisis, is that people have thought that we were working in a world of machines, and we're actually working in a world of complex systems. So whereas machines can be taken apart, they can be analyzed, and they can be fully understood, they are ultimately no more than the sum of their parts. And whereas they exhibit normal, I sound like I'm proposing a bill in those comments, whereas they exhibit normal or equilibrium patterns of behavior, as I was suggesting again with that clock, and critically, they show proportionality between cause and effect. Small causes cause small effects. Big causes cause big effects. And as a result, machines can be managed because their behavior is predictable. With complex systems, we have a very different situation. They exhibit emergent properties. They are more than the sum of their parts. You put the pieces together and they start doing things that you don't expect, even if you have complete knowledge of all the parts. They can flip from one pattern of behavior to another. They have what are called multiple equilibria. And in the world economy, we've seen a flip from a stable state to a turbulent state. It's quite possible that the climate has multiple equilibria too. And this is as a result fundamentally because they show disproportionality between cause and effect. Their behavior is often what is called by specialists nonlinear. Small causes can cause big effects, and sometimes big causes or big changes in the system don't really do much at all. And because of all these things, complex systems cannot be easily managed because the behavior is unpredictable. And what this means is that we are moving fundamentally from a world of risk to a world of uncertainty that's populated by unknown unknowns.
My takeaway is we develop models of reality by focusing on certain problems. The economy, the energy system, our food supply, population. In fact, each of these are finely balanced in time and heavily interconnected. For example, new research shows climate systems are far more fragile and unstable than we thought. Even a relatively small change in atmospheric gases can trigger massive changes from a glacial world to a tropical one. Likewise, in agriculture, a change of less than 2 degrees or a sudden heat wave can remove some of the most productive rice and wheat growing areas in the world, and all of that can happen within a single lifetime or two. We've just learned about this climate sensitivity and rapid shifts from exhaustive scientific exploration done in the last decade. No wonder the wider public hasn't realized our precarious situation. It took several centuries for the average person to accept Galileo's assertion that the Earth revolves around the sun, contrary to our sense of the sun rising. We don't have a century to communicate the decline of oil and the coming climate chaos. Both are already upon us. And this time now, it's just the easy beginning.
The last time the temperature of the planet was 2 degrees above the 1900 level was 130,000 years ago. That was during the last interglacial period, or period between glaciations. And sea levels at that point were 4 to 6 meters higher than they are today, largely because of the melting of Greenland. The last time the temperature of the planet was 3 degrees above the 1900 level was 30 million years ago. Now that's where 3 degrees is where we're projected to be, and this relatively conservative estimate by the end of this century. It was 30 million years ago, and sea levels at that time were 20 to 30 meters higher than they are today. I mean, think about the implications of that for London. Now, as we'll see later in my presentation, if we get the 3 degrees, it's extremely unlikely, without direct intervention in the atmosphere, by that I mean geoengineering, it's extremely unlikely if we get to 3 degrees that we're going to be able to ratchet the temperature back. So we will be committing the planet over a period of time. This kind of melting takes hundreds of years potentially, but we will be committing the planet to sea level rise in the tens of meters, easily within a historical period that will be shorter than, for instance, the existence of the London in human history to this point. Much shorter.
As regular listeners know, I've been harping away at the dangers climate shift poses to our food supply. One factor is crop burnout. The year may be or may not be particularly hot, but just a week or two of superheat can wipe out crops meant to feed many millions of people. Thomas Homer Dixon summarizes new research on this very problem.
For global food production, this is a paper that was released in Science in January, which I found particularly important. What these researchers did is they started from the premise that many of our crops, our most important food crops like wheat and corn and rice, are very susceptible to short periods of very high temperature of over 40 or 42 degrees. You get a precipitous decline in yield, they basically die. So you want to know what the probability of very high temperatures during the summer might be in the future. So what they did is they went out to 2040 to 2060, and they asked what is the probability of any summer during that period of time in a particular region being warmer than any summer to record, any summer on record to date. So just to give you an example, here in North America, there are three areas in particular, Florida, Arizona, and California, which are critically important food-producing regions for Canada. During the winter, we get a lot of our food from those regions. And if you can see that they're in orange, and to read the diagram, it means you've got a 70-90% chance, according to these models, that any given summer between 2040 and 2060 will be warmer than the warmest summer on record between 1900 and 2006. Okay, so a significant probability of heat shock. Now, you might say, well, okay, it looks like the world is warming, but it looks manageable. Let's go out towards the end of the century. Now, this is 2080 to 2100, the time when we have not 6.7, but 9 billion people on the planet. Very large areas of the planet, including critical food-producing regions where about 40 to 45% of the world's population lives, in East Asia and South Asia, have a 90 to 100% chance that any given summer will be warmer than the warmest summer on record between 1900 and 2006. Now, as a political scientist who studied the relationship between environment and conflict, I look at that map and I see that's a prescription not only for food catastrophe, but for social catastrophe across the planet. And that was exactly what the authors suggested. They said we need to get going now as quickly as possible to be developing food grains that can withstand severe drought and severe heat. It turns out it takes a long time to develop those grains.
Homer Dixon foresees a climate-caused calamity in northern China. The change in the Arctic may mean monsoon rains don't reach North China to the wheat fields, but instead flood the south. This could lead not just to widespread hunger, but political instability in the world's most populous nation. He brings up an open question between two leading economists, Harvard's Martin Weitzman and Yale's Bill Nordhaus, on the so-called fat-tail debate. The fat tail is a widening in model predictions of global heating beyond the limits discussed by today's politicians and even mainstream environmental groups. Some models predict a real possibility of warming of 5 or 6 degrees Celsius or even higher. Homer Dixon does not say that a warming of over 5 degrees by the end of this century likely means mass extinction for most mammals. But he does admit such changes could at least mean the end of human civilization. My friends, scientists are now debating whether we can survive our greenhouse gas pollution. The second part of this one-hour speech is about the relationship between fossil fuels, especially oil, and our increasing population. There is no way to support 6 billion people, much less the predicted 9 billion, without a lot of affordable oil. But the world's major oil fields are in decline, and we are not discovering anywhere near enough oil and gas to replace what we are using. Oil will decline, perhaps steeply, within 20 years, and what will we do then? Homer Dixon thinks humans will find a way to burn coal underground, keeping emissions below the earth, and converting that coal to useful gas. The cleaner gas would then fuel electric generating plants, perhaps for an all-electric transportation system and general industrial needs. He also predicts we will turn to geoengineering in a last attempt to preserve the Arctic and the general climate. Nuclear power would also be part of his mix. All that is set against the real background of continually growing fossil fuel emissions. Even by 2006, our greenhouse pollution was already beyond the worst scenario considered in the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. Every bit of CO2 commits us to at least another century of climate change, if not more.
The climate change that takes place due to increases in carbon dioxide. Now, this is a paper that just came out about 2 months ago. Climate change that takes place due to increases in carbon dioxide concentrations is largely irreversible for 1,000 years after emissions stop. Following cessation of emissions, removal of atmospheric carbon dioxide decreases radiative forcing, but it is largely compensated by slower loss of heat to the ocean, so that the atmospheric temperatures do not drop significantly for at least 1,000 years.
Our very own 1,000-year Reich of heat. In his question and answer period with UK legislators, Thomas Homer Dixon finds an underlying economic cause, our need for never-ending growth. He says that is a fatal fantasy, which must end, being replaced by some sort of steady-state economy. The market may turn into cooperatives. Population, he says, is also driving climate change, saying that 20% of all children born today are unwanted. And finally, consumers must transform themselves into problem solvers with a better sense of the meaning of life. He sees no possible return to the old age of oil and its assumptions.
That's how it was at the end of the age of oil.
We've been reviewing a speech by author and professor Thomas Homer Dixon given to the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Peak Oil and Gas on May 6, 2009. The topic was Responding to the Converging Crises of the 21st Century. Find the full speech, Q&A, and slides at appgopo.org.uk. I'll spell that for you, appgopo.org.uk. Or find my Radio EcoShock blog entry for June 11th, 2009 at ecoshock.org. I'll put links there as well. Of course, you can download this and all our past programs as free MP3 files from our website. We have another speech by Thomas Homer Dixon in the 2008 program archive. Look for Climate, Who, If Not Us, with Thomas Homer Dixon, recorded in Toronto and broadcast March 20th, 2008 at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Our opening clip came from Val Kilmer's new movie, Steam Bath. Peabody Coal Facts from Making Contact at RadioProject.org. Wrap-up music by David Rovix.
It's a boiling point, and the heat is on, and pretty soon, it'll all be gone. Time is short, to change the score, or look in Webster's for dinosaur. 24 years, 90%, get evicted or pay the rent. There are just two words that will decide: carbon dioxide. Does anything matter?
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We go now to a program first broadcast on Radiance FM in London. It's Climate Radio, with host Phil England asking, can the developing economic depression help save us from climate disaster?
In the Great Depression, emissions fell by some 35% between 1929 and 1932, and he's predicting an even greater fall with the recession or depression, as he sees it, that we're going into. And he was quoted at the end of last year as saying that he thinks that the downturn is much more severe than economists realise, and we may see a 40 to 50% CO2 emissions fall globally between now and 2012. Now, if we do see a 40 or 50% emissions cut globally, then that is more than anyone been conceivably hoping for from a climate change perspective, and we will need to move very fast to both support the humanitarian impacts of that economic freefall, but then also to lock in the carbon savings that come with it.
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, a syndicated radio program that campaigns for a safe climate. And on today's show, we're going to be looking at some of the ways that the climate crunch and the credit crisis are interreacting. But we're going to go straight to an important race now. We can bring you live from the grassy knoll at the Global Meltdown Derby.
Time for the jockeys' nerves to set in. They're under starters' orders. Tsunami waves of fear engulf the market, and they're off. Wave of panic hits, further fragilities predicted, crisis strikes sandy shore, making a pretty good start. Sublime, sublime mortgage looking shaky as they come around the first bend. Downright greed from harbing of war, 5 years down the long, torturous, blood-soaked road, loading and fair in Wall Street, following short selling, ninja loans, derivatives, stifling, suffocating sorrow and inner sanctum running well. High rollers rolling in the bankers, gambling bonanza, as worldwide famine running good on the inside. James Dane and Bear Stearns looking beleaguered, economic breakdown. Hedge funds to followers of Beaches Brook, also a follower to FTSE. Worst false is 9/11. Recession fears spark global share collapse, charging down the field. Blue Mondays followed by Black Wednesdays on from Black Fridays, wiping 77 billion off cities. Blue stocks come to the next fence, with boxer Joe Lewis blowing $1 billion on the day. Credit crunching gowls haunting global market, betting shares collapsing to obscure corners. Financial zombies are surfacing. Another takeover, a lot of turbulence, indiscriminate moving in the middle of the field. Head honchos of Merrill Lynch, Citigroup, Swiss UBS are well out of the race to complete global meltdown. The market is needing more money. Federal Reserve rescue battle for resolution as the Trump canal turn. Wild durations in Wall Street and Singapore Joe. Singapore Joe injects $5 billion into Merrill. China makes flexes growing financial muscle. Snaps up 12% of Rio Tinto and Dawn raid. Sisyphus the leader. Sisyphus the pushes Northern Rock uphill for eternity. Olympic torch being pushed out of the race. Billions borrowed. Downright greed charging up the hill from excess corporate tax exemptions and a lot of money buried in tax havens. The drama surrounding big bank bailout unfolding. Debt rising. Greedy speculators spreading scandalously false rumours. Pirate Captain JP Morgan to the rescue train by User of Blair, warmongering peace envoy for the Middle East. Further back, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac and AIG. Toxic assets followed by economic slowdown on from consumer credit with price of commodities, oil, rice, copper and wheat went to an all-time high. Had dramatic effect as we face a deceleration. On from emergency stop, had been travelling at too formidable a pace. Now it's shell-shocked. ExxonMobil announced record profits riding roughshod. HBOS banks trying to claw their way back from the brink. Back from the brink on from global warming. Global warming running a fast race. Gaia can't take much more. Amazonian forests and other followers have come to the open and ditch. Kevin King pumping more into the financial system, ensuring banks can't be brought down by heavy going. Right there in the centre is liquidity crisis, heading for the chair. Frank Lloyd, fairing new discrepancy to system. Rogue traders had been jumping well in the middle of the field. Car industry's big tree on the road to ruin. Global warming with sublime. Tens of thousands of homes to be repossessed, unemployment rising rapidly, recession followed by depression, pushed hard by Bush boy, apocalyptic rider with two left to jump, it's Bush boy to follow, with Barack Obama looking strong, promising more troops to Afghanistan, now a select committee taking up the running, putting the pressure on dynamic disgraces, gracias to whistleblower overtakes fastest chief, dodgy dealing and using too much whip on from Murbus, flashless Gordon Sir Teddy looking stunned on the rails, gracias to Amron, another Russian oligarch, defaulting, gangrene dinosaurs of world banking gout ridden on their knees, with all round profound apologies and more backslapping and backstabbing. Still demanding big, mega big bonuses as economy is careening to disaster. Politicians blowing thousands on expenses. Still sitting on many corporate boards as we come to the final fence. Taxpayer left holding banksters illegitimate baby as peripheral countries face famine after years of debt servicing and debt peonage. Harbinger for jumping well is still global warming ahead of worldwide famine on the home straight. Worldwide famine overtaken by downright greed with two farms from home. Global warming is thundering strong on the inside from downright greed and as to come across the line is global warming ahead of downright greed followed by worldwide famine. Then comes Harbinger for war with great cheers from the crowd for the outsider. Global warming.
Okay, you've been listening to the Global Meltdown Derby performed by Grassy Knoll, an Irish poet living in London, who we hope to catch up with at the end of the programme when he's managed to catch his breath back. I invited Knoll in because I think it's a clever evocation of the converging crisis we now face, and it echoes something that Lord Nicholas Stern said recently in a talk to launch his new book. A member of the audience asked him if there was a danger that politicians would be distracted from the problem of climate change by the economic situation. Only if they have small minds, was his reply. We're going to be looking at the relationship, as I say, between the economic downturn and climate change, and asking whether the former might be our best hope of solving the latter. And this is one of the questions I put to Tim Helveg Larsen, director of the Public Interest Research Centre think tank, who was a co-author of the important Zero Carbon Britain and Climate Safety Reports. Before we hear that interview, though, Kevin Anderson, research director of the Tyndall Centre, the UK's leading climate change policy research institution, speaking at the launch of the Climate Safety Report back in November 2008 and reinforcing the message from last week's programme about the need to move international and national climate policy away from long-term targets to emissions budgets and emissions trajectories.
Now, targets, traditionally, I think probably many of you have heard about this recently, we've talked about long-term targets, 80% reduction by 2050 or 60% reduction by 2050. It's all about 2050 or 2100. It's not about now. Out of our term of office, I think is one of the terms some people use. CO2 stays in the atmosphere for well over 100 years, well in excess of that now. So in fact, that's not really the appropriate way to look at the problem. You really have to say that these final percentage reductions have almost nothing to do with climate change. What matters are the cumulative emissions, as the emissions build up day in, day out, year in, year out. This fundamentally rewrites the whole chronology of climate change. It moves us away from these long-term gradual reductions that we traditionally are used to, towards urgent and radical reductions. This is Mr. Stern again. Annual reductions of greater than 1% per annum only ever been associated with economic recession or upheaval. We're getting a bit more used to this now anyway. But that is only 1%. Now let's look at the best example we actually have of doing something. The UK dash for gas, big reduction from emissions because we swapped from coal to gas, or the French 40-fold increase in nuclear power over about 20 years. These are the best examples that we've got of moving into a low-carbon supply route. It wasn't for those reasons, but that's what we did. They were only linked with about a 1% per annum reduction, and that excluded aviation and shipping. So basically, the best example we have historically had no reduction in emissions. But there is an example out there which you can rely on. The collapse of the Soviet Union gave us 5% reduction in emissions per annum for about 10 years. A reality check on this. If economic growth is not possible with 6% per annum reductions in emissions, and I think most of us would probably say that's a little unlikely, then we have no option, it would appear to me, I would look forward to hearing any other options than this, than having a planned economic recession.
Kevin Anderson, he's basically arrived at the conclusion that what we need is a planned economic contraction on an unprecedented scale, perhaps a kind of faster wind down of economic activity than they saw in Russia during the 1990s. We could say in climate terms that it's been lucky for us that we have had such a downturn over the last year or so. Does it look likely that emissions are coming down as a result of that?
It does look like they are coming down. I haven't seen the very latest figures, but a couple of months ago it was looking like the UK's emissions had dropped by 2% against the same time in the previous year. And it's a tricky one to manage and understand because it basically complicates the climate change message. Here we are in a situation where we can see fossil fuel use has been growing exponentially, and the message must clearly be that we have to stop that. And then if emissions cuts come from an unexpected quarter, namely economic recession or depression, how do we deal with that? And surely we should be grateful for those cuts, but they also come with pain, obviously. And there's a climate change concern as well, that we need to make absolutely sure that these cuts, wherever they come from, are locked in. So when Kevin Anderson talks about a planned economic recession, that's absolutely the last thing anyone in the world of politics or business wants to hear. But there's more than a grain of truth in what he's saying, that we really do need very large short-term cuts. I saw in figures that came out just yesterday were showing that Germany over the last year has its GDP has dropped by over 6%, and I think, if I remember Kevin Anderson's figures correctly, Russia was collapsing at 5% a year. So Germany is already experiencing that in the last year, and this last quarter seems to be even more harsh. I think what this all stems from is really that we've been finding it much easier to borrow money than to save money. And when you have this ready access to money and the purchasing power that it brings, it means you can buy an awful lot more fossil fuel and an awful lot more capacity to burn it than you would have if you were busy saving. So when we hear about credit crunch, it's really saying that there's a pause or a stop in that process of accessing money beyond our means, and therefore accessing carbon and fossil fuels beyond our means. The idea of emissions reductions coming from unexpected quarters isn't completely off the wall. Terry Barker is the director of the Cambridge Centre for Climate Change Mitigation Research, and he was saying that in the Great Depression, emissions fell by some 35% between 1929 and 1932, and he's predicting an even greater fall with the recession or depression, as he sees it, that we're going into. And he was quoted at the end of last year as saying that he thinks that the downturn is much more severe than economists realise, and we may see a 40 to 50% CO2 emissions fall globally between now and 2012. Now, if we do see a 40 or 50% emissions cut globally, then that is more than anyone been conceivably hoping for from a climate change perspective, and we will need to move very fast to both support the humanitarian impacts of that economic, well, freefall, but then also to lock in the carbon savings that come with it. I think it's going to take a very careful look to see who is suffering and where the pain is. We clearly don't need to worry too much about screams from bankers, but there are going to be real people all over the world who are affected by an economic collapse of that order. And I don't really know if that's what the probability or likelihood of that happening is, but I wouldn't discount it entirely. I think when we talk about sustainability or unsustainability, we're talking about a period within now or the next 12, 24, 36 months probably, where we find that you cannot sustainably travel up an exponential curve. At some point it collapses, and that's the case as much for our money system as it might be for our access to fossil fuels.
I mean, also, if it wasn't for the climate situation, which has a greater urgency, I think it's clear now, we'd also be seeing some economic contraction ahead through peaking oil supplies, which somebody like Colin Campbell has made clear.
Yeah.
But Ed Miliband is resisting the idea that we should start talking about a non-growth story, so a low-carbon future that isn't about economic growth and is more about well-being. His argument is that if we say that a low-carbon future is a low-growth story or a negative growth story, then China won't sign on to an international deal. Have you got a response to that?
Well, I think what Mr. Miliband is probably experiencing is that there is a very rich and detailed and prosperous picture that's been painted of a world in growth. And the same rich and detailed picture hasn't yet, I don't think, been painted for a steady state economy, for a sustainable economy. And that's absolutely something that, that we should be supporting him in. Maybe it's for him to do himself, but when he says that a steady state economy is not a message that is going to be swallowed by China, we have to ask ourselves, why is it that we haven't been able to communicate the sort of the extra benefits of even the economic benefits of efficiency, the economic benefits of using renewables instead of fossil fuels, the social benefits of getting to know your neighbours more by moving more locally, being closer to your the means of production for your food and your services. That picture is still fairly clunky and clumsy. I find it clunky and clumsy to talk about because it's so foreign from the world we live in today. But we need to build that picture in a very rich and detailed way if we want to draw politicians and countries towards him.
Okay. Again, going back to Kevin Anderson and Alice Bowes, we have this tiny emissions budget available to us, and we really want to get to zero carbon as soon as possible,
yep.
I think is the message of the Climate Safety Report. And you've factored in all the observational science that's coming out of the Arctic.
Yep.
So, yeah, what Kevin Anderson and Alice Bowes have been saying for some time now is that really to keep within such a tight budget, we really need to act fast and to make early cuts as soon as possible.
Absolutely.
And one of the biggest tools we've got in our kind of policy box is demand reduction.
Yep.
And they say we should refocus on demand reduction. But again, this isn't something that the government is starting to talk about or appears to have heard currently.
I think it's the same issue as steady state instead of growth. Demand reduction is absolutely talking about moving on to a steady state footing. And it's not as politically attractive as the fashionable story of growth. There are all sorts of technical reasons and social reasons why a steady state economy would be a better economy and a more wholesome and fulfilling economy than a growth one, and why demand reduction is absolutely needed. What we've got to do, it's incumbent on all of us, is to find the ways to communicate that. I think the key point is from Kevin and Alice is unavoidable. We have to be making these cuts, and we have to be making them now. And what we saw very clearly as we got to the end of writing the Climate Safety Report was that really any stabilization level for greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, whether it's 450, 550, or down at 350, or even lower, if you want any hope or any chance of reaching those, you have to be on the reductions track right now. You have to be moving hard and fast towards zero carbon right now. And so really, given the uncertainty about climate change, and yet given the very large scale of it and the great urgency that we're seeing from work looking at carbon budgets that Anderson and Bowes are doing, it's clear that we have to just get on that track, and only once we're on that track racing out of carbon will we have the luxury to fine-tune our trajectory and see if or what stabilisation level we need to stabilise that.
George Monbiot was saying we could reduce carbon emissions by 25% by 2012, which is very soon and very, very quick. I'm not sure if anyone's looked at his suggestions and whether they stack up or not.
Yeah.
But if the UK government kind of took this approach, there'd be certain an advantage in us leading from the front in that way, yeah?
Yeah, it's absolutely a reason and a need to, as you say, lead from the front. I think the way I would look at it or frame it is that the negotiations that we've had internationally, these UN climate negotiations, have embodied a culture of apportioning blame, really, or apportioning, they talk about burden sharing. It's like there's this much burden. Obviously, we're trying to avoid the burden of climate change, but we have to take on the burden of economic hardship. So let's split it like this, and you take all of that economic hardship, and I'll just take this little bit of economic hardship. So it's all sort of pushing around hardship and burden, responsibility, and really, if we as a nation can, if Britain or any country, in fact, can actually start demonstrating that they are making real cuts in greenhouse gas emissions now, and that they're doing it because it's the right thing to do, and they're doing it because it saves them money, they're saving money because they are more efficient in the way they use energy, and they're saving money because the energy that they do use is coming from renewable sources, which means that they don't have to pay for fossil fuels. So
if Britain can go into those international negotiations and say, this is the cut that we are making now. We're making a cut now because we have to be on this track out of carbon, and we're making this cut now because it's right for an awful lot of reasons. And how can we learn from the rest of the world about the approaches that they're taking, and how can we help the rest of the world? That would be such a completely different approach. It would, I think, change the game if countries could go in with that positive attitude of this is what we're doing. Because a nation faces the same problem that any individual faces with climate change, which is that for the climate change to be solved, or for us even to begin solving climate change, we have to take action ourselves, and we have to trust that everyone else is going to take action. And it's a very difficult thing to do because we aren't in control of everybody else. And all we can do is to take action ourselves and show the world, show other people that we're doing it and that it's the right thing to do, and hope and trust that they will do so too.
Okay. Going back to demand reduction, the Zero Carbon Britain report was basically a mixture of power down and power up.
Yep.
So in terms of power down, that's demand reduction, just using less,
yep,
reducing our energy demand overall by 50% was the scenario.
Yep.
And that was achieved through carbon rationing. Is that still your preferred method or approach to demand management?
I think it is. There's
or a version of that, because there's domestic tradable quotas and tradable energy quotas as well.
One has changed name into the other now. I think that there are a number of advantages through doing it with a scheme like tradable energy quotas. It means that you start off with a very clear cap that is designed to match the amount of carbon that been scientifically decided we can burn, and then it provides a first approximation, a very good approximation, I would hope, at sharing that carbon out equitably. And what it crucially does, which might otherwise be missed, is that it engages everybody in the country in an awareness of this carbon problem and of getting off this carbon problem. So if any individual person is going to buy petrol or gas or a sack of coal even, they have to hand over these carbon permits. And so it makes those fossil fuel, those carbon transactions, feel very real to people. And it provides a way of, if you like, uniting all the people and businesses in the country with the government to tackle this problem and get really creative and innovative about finding ways of avoiding using these fossil fuels.
Do you have any other big picture stuff that you'd like to throw in about what the science is really telling us now in terms of how we need to move forward?
Well, in terms of big picture, you've quite rightly pointed to the need for demand reduction as the first port of call, and it absolutely is. I'm guilty as the next person that I find it easier to sell the idea of renewable energy than I do of making savings. And so with that caveat in place, I'll just tell you what's exciting me at the moment, which is that Britain has an absolutely vast energy potential offshore, both in terms of our offshore wind resource, but also the untapped wave and tidal potential. The point I always make about marine technologies, wave and tidal, is that moving water being 1,000 times denser than air, moving water is carrying 1,000 times the energy of air that moves at the same speed. Now, it doesn't always move at the same speed, and there are different places where you'll be able to tap it than you can tap wind. But that's a technology that we've only just begun to get a sniff at, and it's not surprising that the marine technologies that have been shown to succeed or have been most promising were not the ones that were designed to be most efficient. They were the ones that were designed to survive. And the technology has moved on a little bit further now, so that it's now not just the technologies that were able to survive those incredibly powerful conditions, but it's the ones that are cost-effective to maintain. So where you can lift them out of the water, for instance, very easily and change the bearings or re-grease this or that. So I'm very keen to understand the full economic value of our offshore renewable resource. And the reason that I say the economic value is that I suspect that the economic value of our renewables will get far more traction within Whitehall than will an understanding of the energy potential or of the carbon mitigation potential of that energy. And I think when we look into it, which it's only a matter of time before these numbers start surfacing. What we'll see is that it's going to be worth hundreds of billions of pounds. We've got the single largest offshore wind resource of any country in Europe, and it's significantly larger than our domestic demand for energy. And what we need to recognise is that actually that offshore potential is an export commodity for Britain. It's something that we could be exporting into Europe as zero carbon electricity, and it can also be saving us money through avoided fossil fuel imports for our own energy use. And in doing that, we're going to build an absolutely world-class expertise in these technologies, which is yet another sort of economic boost. So I'm very keen to see numbers put to this and to see a full economic valuation of our vast offshore energy gold mine, really.
That was Tim Helveg Larsen, director of the Public Interest Research Centre think tank and co-author of the Zero Carbon Britain and Climate Safety Reports, with some useful insights, I think, there. And in other news, on May the 26th, the trial of Ken Saro-Wiwa versus Shell finally gets underway in New York, over 13 years after Saro-Wiwa was hung with, I think, eight of his fellow campaigners. And one of the things they were campaigning against was gas flaring, amongst other things. And Shell's gas flaring continues in the Niger Delta. And there's a renewed campaign in the light of the trial to bring that finally to an end. It's, of course, a terrible waste of carbon emissions and natural gas, and it does environmental damage to the local community there. And we still have Grassy Knoll in the studio with us, who has been involved with a similar, or seen how Shell works firsthand in the battle that they're having. I think it's been going on for 9 years in County Mayo. Perhaps you could bring us up to speed on what's happening there and what that campaign is all about.
Well, the campaign, as he's rightly say, begun 9 years. Shell have been trying to build a massive big refinery in Mayo. The land was more or less given to them by the Irish government for a very, very minimal fee. It was land that was originally forestry land. It's in a beautiful estuary. It's an environmentally protected area. And at this moment in time, they're trying to make the final link up to the pipeline. On last year, there was a big problem because Shell were unable to link up because Maura Harrington, one of the local teachers, a retired teacher now, went in hunger strike and disabled Shell by proceeding with the works at that moment in time, because they thought internationally it would be a fiasco with the negative publicity had she died in this particular moment. And at the moment, there's a lot of fishermen still involved in the campaign, a lot of local farmers. Indeed, Willie Carduff was nearly beaten very, very badly by the security, 15-year security, dressed in black with black balaclavas, on the second anniversary of him winning an international environmental award.
Right, so the struggle goes on. And I understand that there's been a link, a kind of solidarity between the campaigns in Nigeria and County Mayo as well.
Well, at this moment in time, I'd like to say there's been a lot of international solidarity, and Ken Saro-Wiwa's brother has come over, his nephew, as far as I'm aware, has been over there. A lot of other support has come in from Nigeria. A lot of support has come from England over the years as well. It's one of the things that people overlook, that the English have actually, a lot of people have gone over to the camp, and a lot of people have actually supported it. A lot of people throughout the world have come to Ireland to actually support this particular fight, because it is a very, very small amount of farmers that are putting up a very, very good fight against a transnational corporation. One of the wealthiest last year they announced their profit. I think it's the biggest corporate profit that any company in Britain has ever made.
And there's a week of international action against Shell's various abuses starting. I think maybe it's already started. There was the Shell AGM on Tuesday, and there were fire eaters outside of that, amongst other things. And the place to get the update on the trial, which should be bring out some amazing information, I think, if you go to www.shellguilty.com, I think you can follow the trial as it kind of unfolds over the next few weeks or perhaps even months. And there must be a web link for the County Mayo campaign as well.
Yes, shellguilty.com, and there's a big meeting out there. A lot of people are coming from England, from around the world, for 1st of June. There's going to be a lot of major protests, and that this week the government is actually questioning whether or not they have the right to compulsory purchase this land, because at this moment they don't own the land.
Right, okay, so Shell's still got a few battles to fight if it wants to get its own way up there.
I think for the sake of the environment and the whole west coast of Ireland, there's a lot of oil, a lot of gas out there. I mean, once the gas is in, presumably the oil will follow and it'll have detrimental effects to the whole west coast of Ireland.
Okay, we've run out of time. Thanks again very much for coming in and
it's been a pleasure
performing earlier for us. And just to say, references for this week's programme and to listen again, go to climateradio.org. And thanks for listening.
That was Climate Radio from England, wrapping up this week's Radio EcoShock show. I'm Alex Smith. Download this and all our programs from our website at ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.